On behalf of F5 and Carahsoft, we would like to welcome you to today's podcast, focused around Zero Trust, where Scott Rose, computer scientist at NIST and a co-author on NIST's 800-207 Zero Trust Architecture publication, Gerald Caron, Director of Enterprise Network Management for the Department of State, Brandon Iske, Chief Engineer at DISA, and Jason Wilburn, Zero Trust Engineer at F5, we'll discuss the pros and cons of different Zero Trust designs, how other federal initiatives tie into Zero Trust, and understanding what Zero Trust principles do for cybersecurity posture.
Thank you, Bowden. And once again, thanks everyone for joining. My name is Ryan Johnson. I'm a Solutions Engineering Manager with F5 Government Solutions. Today we have a group of exciting guests, mostly from the federal space, to discuss Zero Trust in theory and kind of define, talk about the implementation of Zero Trust. First off, I have Scott Rose with NIST. Scott, would you like to talk a little bit about yourself?
Sure, thanks. I'm Scott Rose. I'm currently at the Information Technology Lab at NIST, and I am the co-author of the NIST special publication 800-207, Zero Trust Architecture, and also attached to the as a subject matter expert for the upcoming NCCOE, or National Cybersecurity Center of Excellence, project on Zero Trust Architecture.
Well, thank you, Scott. If anyone hasn't had a chance to read that 800-207, definitely take a look. It's well worth your time. Next off, we have Gerald Caron, who's with HHS. Gerald, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm on detail to HHS, but technically I am representing the Department of State, the NES ES. I'm the Director for Enterprise Network Management at the Department of State, basically the infrastructure person, do the network, Active Directory, a lot of the security implementation aspects of things. I am participating and starting to co-chair the CIO's Innovation Council Working Group on Zero Trust. I am Forrester certified in Zero Trust as a strategist as well.
Very good. Thank you, Gerald. Next up, we have Jason Wilburn with F5 Networks. He's an identity and access guru, or SME, if you will. Jason, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Ryan. So I'm a system engineer covering the system integrator space for F5 Federal. But as Ryan mentioned, I am also the co-lead for SME UA, which is anything related to access and authorization controls for our Access Policy Manager product.
Cool. Thank you, Jason. Next up, we have Brandon Iske with DISA. Brandon, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, thank you, Ryan. So I'm Brandon Iske. I'm the chief engineer for our security enablers portfolio. So that includes ICAM, or Identity and Credential Access Management, Zero Trust Reference Architecture Development, Public Key Infrastructure, PKI, and then Software Defined Enterprise. So I'm part of the Defense Information Systems Agency. Again, it's a COMET support agency to the Department of Defense. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Brandon. There are two topics we're going to talk about. The first is the theory behind Zero Trust, understanding federal Zero Trust straight from the source. And the second topic is, the reality, the implementation of Zero Trust. So jumping into the first topic, the theory, this question to you, Scott Rose. You're one of the authors of NIST 800-207 Zero Trust Architecture. Can you tell us briefly what problem Zero Trust is trying to solve and what are the main goals?
Zero Trust is kind of a new paradigm of how you want to look at enterprise security. Basically, it's taking a lot of the trends that we saw kind of going, emerging over the last 10 years or so, and kind of building them together and layering them together to kind of solve what you kind of see as like kind of the attacks that the common script from attacks that you see going out there is where the initial breach happens, the attacker then moves laterally through the network, and then performs the actual attack, ransomware, data exfil, whatever. And then they're not discovered until the next audit, some 6-8 months later. Zero Trust tries to kind of minimize that kind of attack scenario where you segment away or micro segment away resources. You do endpoint security. You do strong authentication both inside the infrastructure, on-prem as well as outside coming in, to kind of limit that lateral movement and make sure that every connection from a client to an enterprise-owned resource is both authenticated and authorized. So the idea is that you want to try, you know, if you don't rely on your perimeter defenses anymore, but you're doing it every step of the way. So there's a little mini perimeter around now every resource and every user. And so that, so you always have total, or at least more knowledge, if not total knowledge, of what's going on in your enterprise.
Thank you, Scott. Next question is to you, Gerald. What is the biggest misconception about zero trust?
First of all, is level setting on the definition that I find is most difficult and people really understanding. And no offense to any of the vendors here, depending on who you talk to, they kind of spin the definition their own way. So getting that common understanding of what zero trust is really important. Some people think it's identity. But it's a little more than that, right? As Scott was saying, it's about protecting what's important and shifting that paradigm in that culture that we do. We're very compliance-focused culture. FISMA makes us that way, FATARA scorecards, things like that. But I think zero trust gets us to a more effective cybersecurity posture. Commonly we've done that peanut butter spread approach where we try to protect everything equally, which Frederick the Great says, if you try to protect everything equally, you protect nothing. I threw that quote up basically, but great IT innovator that he was. But really that peanut butter spread approach is not sustainable. You can't cover everything. You can't, being 100% patched when you have 109,000 workstations across the world is pretty unlikely. So what's important, as Scott was talking about, what's important? And definitely if you need to understand what zero trust is and you're grappling with that definition, yes, definitely don't suggest, but do read 800-207. And I believe, and Scott would agree with me, that that's going to morph as new technologies and capabilities and concepts come about, that is going to morph and mature as we go along on this journey as well.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. This next question's to Brandon. Looking ahead, what are the biggest stumbling blocks for creating a zero trust environment?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So from my perspective, I think within DISA and the DoD, again, we're a very large environment. So I think from our vantage point, just trying to set the standards is really where we're at. So again, we very much leverage the 800-207 as a framework for DoD and what we developed for the Zero Trust Reference Architecture. So we've recently approved that. So that's available internal to DoD right now. So that's kind of our way to get the common framework and language and taxonomy established across the department. Other trends we see, again, a lot of the pillars of zero trust really do rely on existing capabilities and cybersecurity efforts that we have. And from my vantage point, I think there are a few gaps in those technologies, at least for what the department has adopted from an enterprise perspective. And so I'll talk on some of those. But again, I think it's making sure we're doing the existing capabilities, whether it's ICAM, whether it's endpoint, whether it's network segmentation, all those things really have to start coming together. And again, it's eliminating those stovepipes and enabling more API access to these capabilities, tighter integration, and really trying to drive towards conditional access beyond just what we do with PKI, CAC, or PIV today. The one gap I see that the department has been looking at pretty heavily across the board is how do we access our IL5 cloud environments from commercial internet? And really with COVID and mass telework, that's been a big challenge for us is to enable secure collaboration and access to applications and data, but still from kind of most of us being kind of off the network. And so for DoD, that's a big challenge because in those cases, a lot of our designs kind of assume all the users are on inside the perimeter. So this concept really changes that turns the problem on its head. So again, that secure access, we're also looking at kind of some of the SASE type capabilities or secure access edge capabilities. But even in that space, the DoD is large. We're not going to be able to just use one vendor across the board. So trying to drive interoperability of those capabilities, looking at what's kind of best of breed, but also how can we, I don't want to have 10 agents on my computer just to be able to get to different applications across the department. So those are some of the big challenges I think we still see us ahead beyond just kind of the obvious cultural challenges, getting everyone to kind of understand the concept, build their kind of maturity model towards that, and then adopt these concepts and integrations.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you. This is not a single vendor solution by any means. This will be a grouping of different vendors and maybe some homegrown stuff to address these type of issues. Thank you, Brandon. Next question is to Jason Wilburn. Zero Trust makes identity the new perimeter. Why does Zero Trust take this approach?
Well, so one of the things that I always laugh when I hear that it's the new perimeter, because I've heard that it's the new perimeter for like 10 years, right? I think I even have a coin from F5 from like 8 years ago that said identity is the new perimeter. So I guess my wife's car that's like 10 years old is still new to her. So the fact is identity really is a linchpin in a zero trust infrastructure, right? Because without identity, you can't really secure anything, right? Because we have to know who that person is or what is making that request, right? And that becomes really important in a couple of things. One, it's the account creation. Are we creating accounts? Where do those accounts live? And how many entities of that identity actually exist throughout an organization, right? Because the identity of John Smith can exist in multiple places. Really what we're trying to do is reduce the number of identities down to really holistically one single identity for, say, John Smith. But also the next piece in that is really getting down to how they authenticate or how they assert themselves inside of the environment, right? And that really gets down to things like multi-factor enablement, or if we can really get to the holy grail of going full passwordless, right? Which in the federal space, we do a lot of passwordless-based authentication, doing things like smart cards, CAP, PIS, things like that. That's really what we're trying to do, is truly validate that user is who they really are, because to really achieve zero trust, a lot of things revolve around, one, knowing who that user is, and then once that user starts doing things within the network, really should he be able to do those things in those networks, right? Just based off the permission levels and their user behavior and the device they're coming from and where they're going to. But it all really revolves around the first step, and that's just that user account and then truly identifying who that user is.
Yeah, and that kind of ties into what everyone else has said as well, Jason. Appreciate that. Mm-hmm.
Brian, can I add something to that question?
Absolutely.
That identity as the new perimeter thing really scares me, because then people get super focused on identity and saying that's zero trust. And that's just a, for lack of a better term, a pillar, right? And everything Jason said is absolutely important. But if Jason's account got compromised, for instance, what's the first two questions probably the cyber guy is going to ask that's looking at the problem? What did he have access to? And is there exfil? So it actually becomes about the data more than anything. So it's about protecting that data at the end of the day. So I think it's really important. And I think one of the things that really in identity itself is we do it very linear today, where it's one-time authentication, it's one-time access, and then, okay, have a nice day. It's got to be a constant dynamic checking and rechecking of many of the factors, as well as authentication and access. It's got to be continuous.
Yeah, I mean, and you're completely right, Gerald, right? I mean, identity really is just one more data point to determine access to something, right?
Yeah, totally agree. I just like to clarify that that's just one piece of it.
Right.
Of the overall picture.
Yeah.
Not the entire enchilada, if you will.
Correct. Because I see a lot of people talk about it that way.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. Because a lot of places aren't doing that currently, and they think this is the solution, but it's just, like you said, part of the solution.
Right. The enforcement point, right, like to take back to Scott's document, right, with the 207, the enforcement points, right, they will know about the identity, but the enforcement point takes in a lot more consideration beyond just the user's identity, right? There's all that telemetry data that we're getting in, right? What the machine's coming from, what they're trying to access, there's lots more information than just the user identity to determine access control.
Right. And it's not always a human, right? There's That's data right. flowing all the time, and then there's data at rest, you know, so you got to protect that. There's not always a human involved.
Completely, right? So let's go down the road of, like, what do we do with a service account, right? That's coming from and making an API call between from one PC to another PC in the same data center, right? How do you validate that and secure that beyond, really, when I think a lot of times when we talk about zero trust, a lot of times we talk about remote users or just users in general talking to resources. And what we've been trying to get away from is saying the user doesn't really matter where they live. They don't, whether they live in corporate environment or whether they live at home or they're in Starbucks, where the user resides doesn't really matter, because at a network level, that's just an IP address, right? We care about, one, how did they authenticate, and two, what device are they trying to access from, right? Not just, is he on the corporate LAN? The corporate LAN might give us more information, right? And more telemetry, like just being on the Wi-Fi in Starbucks, but it's more than identity, definitely.
One thing that, really hits home for me is, the proliferation of, modern applications and, APIs talking everything. You got APIs on the cloud or even within the same agency or interagency or however. And, Gerald's point about these non-human interactions, verifying those, especially when it's so spread out, different APIs. So to me, that really hits home. The next question is to Scott. There are multiple architectures listed in the 800.207. Why would an organization choose one architecture over another?
Basically, it's they need to look at whatever they're trying to push a zero trust architecture on, what workflow, what mission they're doing, all that will help decide, which model will fit best for them. And also, you got to take into account both, what they may already have owned, or, what technology needs they have, what can they just, what they can use anyway, just configure in a different way. Let's say they already went with vendor A and they have an installed base, but there are certain features that they're not using now, but, as they move towards a zero trust architecture, they just turn those on. Because some things work better than others. Some solutions require like agents installed, and you may not be able to put agents on things, especially if you look at like zero trust or an IoT kind of deployment. You can't push a lot of agents on these small form devices. So you have to go with like a kind of a different model there. But when it comes to like the approaches that we described, like the enhanced identity governance, micro-segmentation, software-defined perimeters, I think of the most mature kind of zero trust enterprises and architectures out there will have elements of all three. It's just basically we call those kind of those three approaches. We're kind of calling those like what is the load-bearing technology that you're using in your architecture, whereas the models are more of what kind of products are you using, that kind of dictates the model. Whereas like what technology are you putting the emphasis on, whether you're the identity management governance part, the micro segmentation part, or kind of using kind of a software defined networking or software defined perimeter model. All those stuff kind of depends on when you're doing that initial analysis, both what is the mission or workflow that you're trying to you're working on to try and make more secure. And then you kind of develop, the set of policies and controls around those. And then those kind of guide you as to which kind of model that you may be going towards.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate that. Next question's to Gerald. Looking into the future, what's next in zero trust? What technologies are going to impact zero trust security or require security in a different way than we see right now?
Oh man, technology moves so fast nowadays, you can't keep up. So, as I'm speaking right now, something new's just come out that I don't know about. But, Brandon, I think, mentioned SASE and edge computing. I think that's something that people are very much looking at. Services through the cloud. One of the things like I advocate for that I'm looking at is I hate being tethered to an on-premise network. We're in a new normal. Everybody's working mobily now. I have to boomerang back just to go back out to the cloud on the internet. So, you know, how can I be untethered but have all the security that I need and telemetry to make the right decisions is something that I'm looking at. So it's something that I advocate for as well. So technology is moving so fast. I think some, you know, are a little more mature than others in this space, but I see it's going to be very much competitive because we're all looking this way now. And I think, as I said before, we're all trying to become more effective at our cybersecurity, not just check the check marks and be becoming compliant. We really need to protect the data and then the things that we need to protect. Like I equate, you know, I got to protect the crown jewels versus the bologna sandwich. You can have my bologna sandwich, but I'm going to put my concentration on those crown jewels. So understanding what's important to you and understanding what the heck is your risk posture. You know, a lot of people struggle with, you know, accepting and understanding what their risk is. There is a lot of non-technical aspects to zero trust that people need to understand. The methodologies, what is your risk tolerance and the processes and what is the data and where is your data and what is that categorization of that data? Those are all non-technical things. And that there's a lot of work in those areas that people do struggle with that I find. So there's a lot. But I see every day, you know, talking with a lot of vendors, that there's a lot of maturity in the space. And I just look forward to seeing some of the capabilities because there's a lot of concepts in 800-207. Like I talked about ongoing authentication and ongoing access. You know, right now it's very linear still. You know, that's something I think, you know, something that would be maturing that people are looking at doing. So there, I think there's a lot and I'm looking forward to it because a lot of people are putting their emphasis here, especially with what we just experienced with the SolarWinds. You know, there's a lot of focus in this area now, even more so if there wasn't before.
And Ryan, if I could add in there, I mean, I think Gerald is spot on. I think as we can build towards more dynamic access, conditional access, and then having applications be aware of that context to govern what I can and can't do within that application. I think that's where as all this comes together, those are the type of outcomes that we start to get at. Whether it's if I'm from a personal device and maybe a low assurance model, maybe I can't download attachments or something, but I can view those or view some content. So those additional granular controls, I think, start to come as out or become achievable once we have some of these capabilities, additional access and aggregation of telemetry together as well.
If I can jump in too, Ryan, I think that just being able to absorb the additional telemetry data, whether it be some sort of behavioral analytics coming out of a risk engine, just coming out of various security tools. I think Scott had mentioned this before, the breaking down of the silos between the teams. And I think that's one of the biggest things about Zero Trust. Holistically, from a security model perspective, what we're saying is that, hey, it all needs to work together at a single point of control that is closest to the resource, right, that Gerald mentioned, right? So, and there can be some sort of context around it that no longer is it just the firewall blocking IPs and things like that, and DLP looking at data exfil, and antivirus looking at what's happening on the server from a virus perspective or malware happening on the client. It all needs to work together and it all needs to come back because that becomes part of the behavior or of the workflow that's happening between the client and the resources they're accessing so that we can truly understand, is this a permitted flow? Yeah, this is a permitted user coming from a permitted device to a resource that he should have allowed to. But based off not just what happened at the very beginning of the session, but what's happening throughout the life of the session, what's changing throughout the life of the session, that becomes critically important to really secure everything day one, right? Because back to Gerald's data exfil comment, right? Cool, you've got access to the data right now. Should you be able to exfil, should you be able to download some document or upload some document 5 minutes into the session based off what something has changed? Maybe not.
Yeah, I agree. That's where we're trying to get to.
Yeah.
All right, that concludes the first topic, the theory. Now we're going to jump into the second topic, the reality, you know, adopting zero trust. The first question is once again to Scott Rose. What components are available to federal entities to assist in forming zero trust architecture?
Well, most of these are kind of, you know, not real solid technologies, but it's kind of more of frameworks and things that may help. I mean, there are existing government programs already out there, both like a DHS, they have their CDM program. There's FICAM, things like that. These are already in place to actually build these kind of like what Daryl called the pillars of zero trust. They've been in place for a while. And it's basically, we kind of looked at how zero trust kind of extends those, how those reliant on those kind of programs. I mean, as well as we have for NIST, there's the risk management framework. That isn't the end all be all, but you can think of that as a kind of a tool to kind of help to go one level down. Once you just kind of develop that architecture, the RMF can maybe help develop that kind of set of controls and checks in place to actually ensure that what you're doing, you're implementing correctly and to your stated goals. These sort of things are in place that are, are basically technology neutral, that whatever kind of vendors you're using, you can always kind of apply these kind of frameworks and tools to kind of help along the way. The special publication 800-207, let's also kind of think of that as a framework, framing that just both on the architects, but also kind of the way that the architects can then talk to like the procurement people. So they can kind of hopefully understand what exactly you want. And so when procurement and the architects talk to the vendors, they're all speaking the same set of terms. They're not just throwing buzzwords back and forth at each other, like randomly zero trust or something like that. There's actually a set of like roles and uses for these technologies that they can both kind of use as like a common set of terms.
All right, next question. Thanks again for that, Scott. Next question is to Gerald. What are the things an enterprise needs to understand before migrating to ZTA or zero trust architecture?
That's a really good question. And that's part of, the difficulty that some folks are going to have. I mentioned the data, understanding the data, where it is, where it's going, and what classification it is, and the where it's going. Where is it normally go? What is the flow? What does normal look like? How do you baseline normal? And that's going to be really difficult, because kind of understanding what normal looks like will depend on when something happens. Now, what actions do I have to take? So understanding, where that data flow is, where the data resides, what it is, who owns it, because you're going to have to work with data owners. This is going to take a village. It's not just the network guys, not just the IT guys. It's going to take a village to do a zero trust, in my estimate, at an agency. But, as Scott was saying, be on the same page with terminology and things like that. But I think that's kind of the difficult part. And I think that answers one of the questions is, how do you know what abnormal is? Well, you got to know what normal looks like to know what abnormal looks like. So I think that's really important. So I like the inside out method, start with the data and then, all right, what's facilitating access to that data? Device, app, what do you do with those things? And then work back to the identity, given the right access to the right people at the right time. And we talk about this from the end user standpoint a lot, and I want to go back to this. The administrators as well are very powerful. So you have to address the administrators, and I think that gets lost a lot of times when people start talking about, they talk about users accessing data. Well, your administrators need to be addressed as well in a zero trust. So that's something that's difficult. And the one other thing I would say that's difficult, Ryan, is that we all, as different agencies, we all share data. We all classify it differently. Like if I want to share with Brandon a certain amount of data, I do sensitive but unclassified, but he may classify it in a different way. Where do we meet when we want to share data with those different classifications so that we can properly do that? And then when I give Brandon my data, it's my data. He's going to be a good steward for it. If he doesn't have the right things in place, now I've put my data out there. So how can we all get on that same page? And interagency sharing is, I think, going to be a challenge as well.
Absolutely. Makes complete sense. That's a big, big challenge. Next question is for Brandon. Is it necessary to have a ZTA if the enterprise does not utilize cloud resources?
Thank you for that question. I would say absolutely. Again, the threat is the same whether you're in the cloud or not. So whether you have disconnected resources or closed networks or connected networks, I mean, you still have very similar threats to some extent. So I think it absolutely applies. Again, whether you look across the pillars, whether it's identity or endpoint, we still have to do those same things. And even what we're doing in DoD to enhance our identity and ICAM processes, again, it's all about authentication and account lifecycle management. Those are the big pieces that we still have a long journey to get to from an enterprise perspective to get those under control in a better fashion than what we do today. We have CAC or PIV programs that are very strong, but again, those are a strong authenticator. It's the entire lifecycle of the additional pieces of identity that come into play. And again, all those same concepts apply regardless of where the data or applications exist. Other efforts that we've done in this arena as well too, I would say, is our cloud-based internet isolation. So again, this is a way that we move the end user browsing to a cloud environment for our actual benefit. And so in this case, basically my browsing session is going to be terminated in a cloud environment. And so from a data protection and exploit perspective, those drive-by downloads basically would happen in that cloud environment, not on my endpoint. So it actually comes to help us also in this mass telework environment as well too. So I can split my traffic going straight to the cloud for browsing and not backhaul that all the way back to the VPN to come onto the internal network. So that's given us a few really big benefits. Again, in a very hybrid model where in some cases we're using cloud, in other cases we still have a huge set of legacy that's still gonna be on-prem for the foreseeable future until they modernize. Or whatever schedule they have to modernize.
So, Brandon, if I could ask a question about the browser isolation component. Mm-hmm. Is this going to be in when a user is accessing internal resources inside of the agencies, or is this going to be also a service that's internet facing? So when a user's setting on prem or anywhere, right, and he's now going to the internet and wanting to go to Google, is all internet traffic really going to be browser isolated? Is that the envisioning?
So it is what we're doing. So the basically .com or any commercial internet browsing mm-hmm. for that capability, okay. And that's .mil is going to bypass that. And so whether I'm on a VPN or the .mil resource is already internet facing, those mm-hmm. are the nuances. So, I mean, basically you have routing either way. So it does allow us to basically not be backhauling that traffic back onto the DoDIN or the internet for DoD terminology. For our internal network.
Thank you, Brandon. Mm-hmm. Next question is to you, Scott Rose. Looking to the future, what is next in Zero Trust? What technologies are going to impact it or require it in a different way than what we see right now? Loaded question.
I don't know for sure because everybody makes predictions and they're constantly surprised about how they don't pan out. But at least in the near term, I see a lot of people focusing both on zero and IoT, we are as well. How do you get those and manage those kind of in an automatic fashion, so you don't actually have to have human administrators going out and touching all those devices or doing something to those devices? Kind of getting to the point where you can just quickly get them onboard them onto a network. You know exactly what they're doing. Because they say what they're doing, and the manufacturer vouches for them, you onboard them, you have to go through the entire life cycle, and you offboard them as you need to, all kind of in a more streamlined, automated fashion. That's kind of going to be kind of coming on as people look for IoT solutions. The other one is we're seeing more people looking at machine learning when it comes to kind of developing user profiles as feedback to kind of what we call like the policy engine or the trust algorithm going on, kind of building up again, what does this user normally do? And then in order to see when something abnormal happens, you always use the scenario of you have a person like saying working in HR and they connect to this database with all the user information and they do, roughly say 3 to 5 gigs of traffic going back and forth from this database a day. Suddenly you see that jump up to 800 gigs. That should cause a red flag going up because that's abnormal. But then again, maybe it's because there's the annual performance review where they're downloading everything and going through everything. Maybe that happens every year at a certain time. Then again, that's you're building up that profile saying, okay, we know that does happen at this certain time frame. So when it happens outside of that time frame, then maybe something strange is going on. Those kind of trends we're seeing, just try and kind of improve the dynamic nature of Zero Trust. That's kind of the things that are just kind of like on the horizon and starting to appear.
Thank you, Scott. And next question is for Gerald. What mistakes or what are the biggest misunderstandings with Zero Trust in the industry or within federal entities right now?
Definition, understanding the totality of Zero Trust, understanding it's a full architecture, a full framework. People talk about it in bits and pieces. Unfortunately, some vendors will, talk about Zero Trust, but you got to understand the whole landscape of it because, they may come in, do the authentication and access management piece, but not do the data segmentation piece or, the app hardening piece or, network mapping for understanding where your data is flowing and things. So understanding that it's not just a one product thing. It is truly going to be an integration. It's going to take a whole effort, a whole village to do it. And so really understanding and getting level set and understanding the use cases and understanding what your risk tolerance is very important. What are you willing to take risk for? What's important to you? And putting your emphasis on what's important. The cafeteria schedule, okay. But your medical records, I'm going to put a little more emphasis on that probably than the cafeteria schedule. So really, and understanding where does that reside? How do I protect that and things? So it really understanding what it is you're trying to accomplish. And then we all have our little special snowflakes, all of our different agencies. So what is our little spin on things? So understanding what your use cases are, I think, is really important.
Thank you, Gerald. Next question is for Jason. Once again, another identity question, Jason. If identity is a new perimeter, what should federal agency entities consider when looking at making identity their enforcement point? How is this achieved?
Still, it's not going to be the enforcement point, right? It's just going to be another piece of information, a data point that can be used by an enforcement point, right? But it, as to Gerald's point, it needs to be looked at holistically, right? Identity just needs to be one part of it. I think the biggest thing is understanding really where are all your identities within an organization? Are they all in Active Directory? Are they all in a SaaS-based IDAS? Do each application have their own directory structure? And so while you think that John Smith account only exists in, say, Active Directory, it might exist in multiple locations, right? So then you need a good strategy to onboard identity, decommission identity, and then also validate identity, right? That means back into needing some sort of MFA or a good authentication method.
Next question is to Scott. What are the concerns a federal entity needs to understand before migrating to ZTA?
The concerns they need to think, that they need to worry about is basically they need to know what they do. They need to know their mission. They need to know the risks inherent to that they're doing their mission. And then they need to know what they have, who both their, the user accounts on the network, the devices, the workflows. They need to have those kind of knowledges first. So they need to be able to detect and monitor things previously before they can actually start moving down this role to Zero Trust. Because you can't really build a policy and a set of checks around things that you don't actually know. Those are kind of like the main concerns. Other concerns are how will it impact the users. You need to, to educate them and make sure everybody else is on board. Because if the other kind of operating units in an organization or a federal agency or something, if they're not on board, there's going to be a problem because the way things are, because they may result in the changes of the workflow of sometimes how they're accessing things, you know, what permissions they have or don't have. There's always that kind of learning curve when you're trying to actually refine these policies. And if that becomes aggravating, they're going to start trying to find ways around it. And that's the last thing you want, because then you have the whole shadow IT kind of springing up behind it, and things that you know, sort of all these strange traffic that you're not seeing on the network, but people claim that's very important for them to do their job. I mean, those sort of things. So you need to actually get, realize that, you know, on going down the road of zero trust is, you know, a kind of a unified front. Everybody needs to take those steps together.
Yeah. Thank you, Scott. Probably the last question here. This is directed to Gerald once again. How does zero trust relate to TIC 3.0 and CDM?
So I think the great thing about CDM, those that have been participating in it, it sets a good foundational things that I think you can build on for zero trust. I think Brandon said it well earlier, is like, you're probably already doing some things and taking a good inventory of some of those efforts that you already have going on and how it fits into the zero trust architecture that, you know, so there may be some tweaks. TIC, I think, definitely is part of a contributor to the solution, especially, you know, some of these efforts that allow for the telemetry and the services to do that untethering that I was talking about and get all that data and make decisions based off that. Definitely. I think the way CDM is taking in and doing like the asset discovery, a lot of the understanding of the mapping, eventually in the subsequent phases later on to do the network access control so you can quarantine or trigger an action on a device. There's a lot of good things that I think they provide some good building blocks that will get you a part of your zero trust solution. Not the totality, of course, we've already talked about that. But I think there's some good foundational pieces that they've put in place that contribute to the overall zero trust architecture.
Yeah, and to follow up on that, if you go through like the part of the NIST 800-207, we have a co-author from DHS, and he's the head of the TIC program. And we made sure that at least the text that we had in those sections where we talk about CDM and TIC, we had a lot of input and overview from DHS there. So we made sure that, the wordings and the both and the tone on both to kind of mesh and they don't contradict. We made sure that, you know, that, we were expressing the fact that these programs are kind of, interlaced.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like more information on how Carahsoft or F5 can assist your federal agency, please visit www.carahsoft.com. Or email us at f5-sales@carahsoft.com. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.